Bell. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The primary issue in this case is whether the work-share discount provision, which is in 39 U.S.C. 3622E, which Congress passed in 2006 as part of the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act, whether that provision restricts the relative prices of separate postal products. Parties obviously disagree on the conclusion, but there's a fair amount of common ground here. The parties agree, for example, that Congress made several fundamental changes when it passed the 2006 law, the biggest one being that it changed the entire pricing model. Under the old law, the Postal Rate Commission was primarily responsible for setting rates, and it did it on a break-even model, where prices were derived entirely from the costs of the postal services. Under the new law, that's been replaced with a modern system of regulating rates for market-dominant products, where the Postal Service can charge market-responsive prices for its products to improve its financial position, subject to an inflation-based price cap. And the hallmark of this modern system is pricing flexibility. But by trying to rewrite the work-share discount provision, and by ignoring other parts of the statute that were enacted at the same time, the Commission has restricted that flexibility and has reimposed the very cost-based pricing model that Congress replaced.
But isn't that in the statute? I mean, the work-share discounts defined or refer to pre-sorting.
Correct.
I think Congress might have spoken in two directions here, in the sense of, yeah, we'll give greater flexibility, but then this provision puts the PRC back in a primary position and defines the statute to have work-share discounts include pre-sorting. I don't know what we're supposed to do with that.
I think Congress spoke with one voice, and I think two propositions that are clear from the language make that clear. The first proposition is that prices, rates, apply to products, that the product is the unit to which a rate is applied. Okay, that's clear from the language of the statute. The term product, by the way, this really points to the centerpiece of the dispute between the parties, is over the meaning of the term product. Okay, that term didn't exist in Title 39 until Congress added it in 2006, and it didn't just add it, it defined it. It's in Section 102.6, and it has three elements. It says the product is a postal service, meaning it relates to mailing, with a distinct market or cost characteristic to which a rate or rates may be applied or are applied. So rates apply to products. Now,
but products is not in 3622.
Exactly, and I think that is our point, actually, that products have rates. 3622 isn't about rates. It's about rate discounts. It's about discounts from rates. So if rates apply to products, it necessarily follows that a discount from that rate is referring to a product, not the relative rates of different products. And to the extent that that's not clear, you turn to, I think, the reporting requirement elsewhere in Chapter 36, which is the only other time work-share discounts come up. It was also added to the 2006 law. And the reporting requirement is part of the annual compliance determination, which is the parties agree is the Commission's primary regulatory tool for ensuring that our various prices comply with the statutory requirements. And they make that determination based on information we're required to provide them. And what is relevant here, and those requirements are in Section 3652. And what is significant here is 3652B, which requires us to provide specific information with respect to each market-dominant product for which a work-share discount was in effect. It's in the legislative history, the Senate report that we cite in our brief, page 20 of that Senate report states that the purpose of that provision, the reporting provision, specifically as to work-share discounts, is to, quote, ensure that work-share discounts are properly established. In other words, that we are meeting the substantive requirement of 3622E. And it simply makes no sense that 3622, the work-share discount substantive provision, would apply to a relationship for which Congress didn't even mandate the provision of any cost information.
Weird way to write the statute then, because you're complaining about a limitation on a discount for pre-sorting, yet the statute specifically requires a limitation on the discount for pre-sorting.
No, Your Honor, we are not saying that it doesn't have a limitation. There's no limitation on pre-sorting. In fact, our argument is this, that the statute, that 3622E means what it looks like it means, that were not retooled.
When would it apply for pre-sorting?
It would apply, for example, we have single-piece first-class mail, which is a product, and we have pre-sort first-class mail, which is a product. The prices for those products are subject to the goals, the various pricing rules set forth for the pricing of products. 3622 deals with discounts from those products. Right. So on the pre-sort product, we offer three discounts for pre-sorting by address, or by sort of, yeah, by essentially by delivery area. We have a one tier for if you sort your mail by distribution center, a second tier if you can sort it by the three-digit zip code prefix, and a third tier for sorting by zip code. All of those are subject to 3622E. And that's, I guess, what we're getting to is that we think the statute, that this provision means what it looks like it means. We're not required to offer discounts from the rates of our products, but when we do, the discount we offer cannot exceed the cost we save as a result of the activities that are subject to the discount. Mm-hmm. Now, their argument to that is that that would allow us to evade the workshare discount limitation altogether by just classifying all these discounts as separate products. And that is just simply not true.
The statute speaks broadly, though. You can say this in a lot of cases, but if the statute were intended to say what you're saying, this is a very odd way to get there.
You know,
They would have, it would have been a lot better for you, and again, you can say this in a lot of cases, but it would have been a lot better for you if used the term product and made clear here what was not talking about this kind of discount from first class.
See, I think regular. We're talking about not the use of the term product. I think everybody would agree that the product is the unit to which a price is applied. I mean, that's what a product is. It's really over the absence of the word product in 3622E. But again, 3622E is, well, first of all, we're already talking about the world of products, and 3622E is talking about discounts. It's talking about discounts from product prices. They're talking about within a product. I mean, it's necessarily what it means, especially when you combine it with a reporting requirement. And as to that point that we would be able to evade...
Could have just said within a product.
It could have said that, but it didn't have... That's the point. It didn't have to, because we're already talking about the pricing of products. That's what subchapter 1 is about. Chapter 36 is called rates. Uses the term rate. Subchapter 1 is rates for market-dominant products. These are the rules for our products.
And you argued that that's clear enough to knock out our Chevron deference.
Yes, I think absolutely. I think, I mean, whether it's just the language alone, but it's the structure of the statute, it's the legislative history, and it's the normal rules of statutory construction that you have to give effect to all the different provisions of the statute, including the reporting requirement, including the definition of product. I think all those things together mean this is a Chevron 1 case. And even if it's not, their interpretation is unreasonable. Our interpretation effectuates it gives meaning to all the terms of the statute and effectuates the purposes underlying the change in the pricing model. Their interpretation produces an anomalous outcome, that the price charge for our most efficient and our most profitable product is derived mechanically from the price of some other product. And it furthers none of the goals of the statute. In fact, the commission's brief suggests that those goals are really irrelevant to this question. And it affirmatively frustrates...
The goals are so conflicting, it's hard to,
I'm sorry?
The goals are so conflicting, it's hard to say there's one unified goal here.
I think that's fair to say, and I think that goes...
Compromise, clearly, of multiple competing interests.
And that speaks to that pricing is designed to be a complicated sort of nuanced undertaking with a lot of goals and a lot of factors to consider. The commission is trying to reduce the most important decision we make, which is the price for our most profitable product, to an exercise in arithmetic.
The statute should have just let the Postal Service charge as it sees fit then.
If it
wanted market flexibility, would be gone.
It's pricing flexibility within certain parameters, but one of the parameters is not this workshare discount provision, which is limited to discounts from rates. It regulates situations where we give a discount or a derivative rate from the rate of a product. I think that's very clear.
Let me stop you and ask you about standing, because the PRC raises standing, and it may seem odd to say that the service cannot, challenge what its boss has done. But as I see it, you have two injuries. That is that this was forced action. You would have come up with a different rate if you hadn't had to do this. And I want to ask you how you've established that. And then your second injury is this loss of future flexibility, as I see it. And to me, that's very speculative. So how have you established both of those injuries? And is there another injury that you have?
Well, I'll speak to the second one first.
All right.
The restriction on our future sort of prices.
Those are the two injuries.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Okay. Those are fair categorizations. But I think the important thing on that second one is this is a rulemaking. This is not an adjudication over whether our present rate design complies with the statute. The annual compliance determinations for that. And it was also not an adjudication over whether single-piece first-class mail and pre-sort first-class mail are separate products. They are. The commission has determined they are. There's a proceeding for that, which is under 3642. This is about our pricing rules going forward. These are about the rules that apply to the decisions we make. And we need to know those rules before we make our pricing decisions in any given year. I mean, price adjustments are an annual occurrence, and they are complicated undertakings. As Your Honor suggested, there are a host of factors we consider, market, cost factors, the policy, the statute, in coming up with a meaningful rate design. We need to know in advance what those rules are. And this is a rulemaking establishing the rules. And we disagree that the rule it came up with, which is that Section 3622E speaks to and restricts the relative prices of separate products. We think that's inconsistent with the statute. And if we couldn't challenge it now, the only thing we really could do is either acquiesce or we could propose a set of rates that we knew would be struck down, that would defy the commission's rule, and then come back here and challenge them then. And I think that there's really no reason for us to have to do that, because in doing that, we will first there will be some uncertainty, certainly, and maybe even chaos in the mailing industry over what our rates are while they're held with suspension. We'll be foregoing needed revenue at that time. And I don't think that the law for a rulemaking requires that we have to actually defy a rule before we can challenge its applicability or challenge its validity. As for the present, present effects, which is what you labeled, I think, our first argument, we can't say that we would have come up with a different rate design but for this rule. We can't say that. We could have said, all we can say is we would have considered it. They foreclosed, really, what happened in the last price adjustment is that the permissible inflation-based cap, if it were applied, for example, to the price of stamps, would have resulted in a price that was in between 46 and 47 cents. And because that's not how we price stamps, I mean, that's not, you know, the whole, as we call it, the whole integer constraint, that the public really doesn't want to spend 46.38 cents for a stamp, that we had to choose between going to 46 and going to 47. Under the commission's rule, we couldn't really go to 47 because that would have violated the permissible gap between that product and pre-sort. So although I can't say we would have come up with a different price regime, we would have considered it. And I will say as well that for the next price adjustment, this problem is going to be even more acute, because what was then a 5.9% permissible cap that the commission says comes out of the statute somehow is now going to be smaller, it looks like. We filed our papers, annual compliance report papers, that suggest that even under the commission's analysis, that number has shrunk. So we can't even maintain the status quo going forward. I mean, we're going to have to artificially raise the price of our most profitable product. And that itself is a problem, because it runs into the problem that rates be just and reasonable as a whole. So they're sending us on a collision course by producing this anomalous result, they're sending us on a collision course with other goals of the statute.
If you raise the prices for the pre-sort, what happens in the marketplace? I'm a little fuzzy on what you think will happen.
We think that if we raise it too much, there's no question that if we raise it, we're going to lose volume, right? So the question is, are we going to lose enough volume that makes it not worth raising the prices? We believe that the answer, if we go too high, is yes. And it's not like these pre-sort, I want to be clear, what we're calling the pre-sort product is really bulk mail, okay? That the term, we call it pre-sort, but it appears in the mail classification schedule as bulk mail, bulk first-class mail, as opposed to single-piece first-class mail, and that's really the primary distinction between these two products. that, you know, bulk mail is really mail for high volume mailers. It's mail for specialists. It's for big businesses with big, massive, you know, single mailings that are subject to a host of other requirements. Our concern, these mailers are not going, if we raise the price too much, they're not going to the single piece product. They're leaving the mail system at a time that we need as much of this stuff as we can get. We can't afford to have our most profitable product and our most profitable mailers leaving the postal system. And that's the effect of having to raise these prices, again, artificially. The statute doesn't command this at all.
How do we know what Congress thought about that prospect?
Because the entire rate design is based on pricing flexibility. It's based on our ability to price our products to the market. It simply makes no sense that Congress would have that as its guiding principle with a host of factors we should be considering, and at the same time make the most important decision, the price of our most profitable product, not really a decision at all. Just index it to some other. In no way does the statute say that. And so it's, even if there's some ambiguity over how Congress structured the statute, I think that ambiguity is resolved by the fact that their interpretation makes no sense. It takes the most important pricing decisions we make, ones that are clearly anticipated by Congress to be ours to make, and turn them into sort of a formula. And that's just not at all what Congress had in mind.
Well, they give on the one hand, take away on the other. That happens all the time.
Well, I don't think they what they gave on the one hand is pricing flexibility.
Exactly.
What they took away is a market-based price cap.
Exactly.
But that's not, that has nothing to do with this.
Right. Well, no. That's the question.
Well, okay. Well, in that case, then the answer is no. That's not what they intended to do. They intended to impose a market-based price cap that gave us flexibility to be nimble in the marketplace, subject to a price cap. In no way does that talk about the relative prices, certainly the through the workshare discount. Why would they through the back door? Why would Congress say all that stuff we just said doesn't mean anything as to the big products? That's just somehow the workshare discount provision means that those can exceed no more than 5.9 cents. None of this is in the statute. The statute is about pricing flexibility. The workshare discount provision is about discounts from prices. It's a limited provision.
Let me give you an example.
Okay.
We're talking about market dominant products, first of all. So is Valpak a bulk mailer?
They're a bulk mailer.
Okay, so if the rate, the market share discount forces them not out of the postal service, but into single piece? You're not going to lose Valpak.
We won't lose Valpak, but we might lose, and they're advertisers. We're going to lose them to Standard Mail, which is far less profitable. That's a whole different class of mail. They're not going to pay the single piece rate. They've made that clear.
Why? I just explain why.
Because it's just not cost effective. It's too expensive. It's too expensive.
Okay.
It's not cost effective for them. So they're not going to accept a bump up to a single piece rate. They are going to either, and it's all the major mailers and the pre-sort bureaus that testified or submitted comments in this case said there one of two things is going to happen. If they can, they'll go to Standard Mail. That's for, you know, advertising and things like that. And otherwise, they're just getting out of the mail. So, you know, for businesses that are
not mailing anything.
Well, they go to email. I mean, this is our problem. This is a problem fundamentally that we face. You're a regulated entity that is subject to an inflation-based price cap with declining volume. I mean, that is already in some ways a recipe for disaster. But what we do have is the ability to try to respond to the market. And the commission's order says, yes, except for 80% of your first-class volume and profit. Why? Nothing in the workshare discount provision, which is about rate discounts, not rates, says anything about that. And I don't think they can come up here and explain why Congress would have designed a system that way. I don't think it's particularly unclear what Congress said. They said products have rates. If you apply a discount from a rate, you're subject to certain rules. But otherwise, you have flexibility to charge your prices to market subject to a price cap. That's a very straightforward reading of the statute, and it's one that, for some reason, the commission fails to adopt, and I think that it violates Congress's clear intent, which is to give the Postal Service pricing flexibility.
All right.
I'm way over.
No, I'm not through with Valpak.
Okay, fair enough.
So Valpak goes from a market-dominant product to a competitive product when it goes to email, if it does.
Well, email's not a product. It's not
right.
A postal product at all. It just leaves the mail system. We make nothing.
Okay.
The standard mail.
Okay, that's right.
Standard mail's
that's
the next
right.
tier of service that is also a market dominant product, but it's far less profitable.
You lose Is there an example of a market dominant product that would move to competitive based on a work share discount?
No, I can't think of any, Your Honor. Yeah. I think our concern and what we face is our main competitor, certainly for mail, is electronic communication. No question about that. And that we have to be able to offer market-sensitive pricing to keep our most important mailers and mail in the system. And this overreading of the statute frustrates that purpose. If the court doesn't have any questions, it would be great to have some rebuttal time, but that's
up
to Your Honor.
We'll give you some time and reply. All right. Mr. Tenney?
May it please the court, I'd like to just start by talking about standing. On the issue that has been discussed this morning, there's a second issue on which we really think they don't have standing, which hasn't come up today. But on the issue that they've discussed, we think it's probably true that they do have standing, as presently advised, primarily because of the last point opposing counsel made, which is that the most recent analysis suggests somewhat more of a restriction on the pricing that they can give. Now, we're still troubled by the fact that they haven't made specific allegations that we're not saying that they have to defy the caps in order to just defy the rules in order to challenge them, but we're troubled by the fact that they haven't made a specific allegation. Here's the rate or range of rates that we would like to apply and feel constrained. But given the change in factual circumstances which came up after the briefing, we think it is likely that they do have standing to challenge this. On the merits,
makes sense. That seems to be the primary message we're getting, is that it wouldn't make sense to read the statute this way. So tell us why it makes sense.
There's a few reasons. One is that what Congress was doing in the workshare discount, I think we all can agree, is limiting the postal service's flexibility. It wasn't unfettered flexibility. It was clearly imposing a limit on the flexibility. And what it was doing specifically was saying, if you're giving a discount to certain mailers who perform certain tasks that make the mail easier to process, one of which is pre-sorting, which is listed in the statute, then we don't want those discounts to be so big that encourages mailers to do work that would be more efficiently done by the postal service. That's clear from the text and the history. We know from the history also that this concept didn't originate in the 2006 statute. This concept had been around for years under the Postal Rate Commission, and it had applied to the difference between single piece and pre-sort first class mail for years. And the Postal Service says, well, that all changed because that was back when we were calling things subclasses, and now Congress, without saying, oh, and this doesn't apply to the difference between these categories, and of course, which categories were going to be denominated as separate products was not known to Congress when it enacted the statute. Apparently, Congress was predicting that these two things would be called separate products by the Postal Service. Congress didn't give the Commission really any power to dispute that because it defined product so broadly that anything with a distinct cost or market characteristic qualifies as a separate product. So the Postal Service goes to the Commission and says, we want these two related sets of mail, and there's ample evidence in the record that mailers are choosing between them based on price. Mailers are deciding whether the discount that they're getting is worth whether it's worth it to get the discount given the costs they have to incur in order to pre-sort the mail themselves. And the commission, it's not clear what the commission was supposed to do. So the commission gets a request to call these two different products. They meet the statutory definition of different products. The commission says, okay. Then the Postal Service comes in and says, okay, now this discount that we're giving among these two things, we don't want you to consider it under the workshare provision, which says nothing about products, because we want, because now that we've defined them as separate products, we get to price them however we want. Now, in response to the point about people leaving the mail, or that this is going to cause harm to their...
Right. Isn't the theory that they need greater discounts to keep people in the system altogether? And your response may be that's a great policy argument, not in the statute, but...
Well, it is in the statute, but it doesn't get you out of the workshare discounts entirely. There are a number of exceptions in the statute, and they can argue that one of those exceptions applies.
Such as?
For example... I'm on page A8 of the appendix. It says, nothing in this subsection shall require that a workshare discount be reduced or eliminated if the reduction or elimination of the discount would, A, lead to a loss of volume in the affected category or subclass of mail and reduce the aggregate contribution to the institutional costs of the Postal Service from the category of subclass subject to the discount below what it otherwise would have been if the discount had not been reduced or eliminated. Now, they can say they qualify for this exception, or they can not make that showing, and if they present that argument to the commission can consider it. But the idea that the possibility, unproven, that that complying with the worst share discount provisions would lose them money means they just get out of the statute entirely is there's just no basis for making that contention. There's other exceptions. There's a general one, reduction or elimination of the discount would impede the efficient operation of the Postal Service. That's 2D, which is just above what I read on A8. You know, they can argue for all of these exemptions. It's not clear, certainly on this record, that any of them would apply or wouldn't apply, but that would be for the commission to make in the course of a future proceeding. But the point is that Congress was imposing a restriction. They meant it to be a restriction. That much is clear. They didn't limit it to products. He says products have rates. Products have a rate or rates. That's in the definition of products. The idea that something stops being a discount because the Postal Service has defined the two things as two different products, there's just no basis for that in the statute. It just doesn't say so. The commission explained in its order the role that products play in the statute. The main distinction is, just stepping back, there are competitive products, which are things that other entities can offer competitively, which would be like express mail would compete, which is, you know, fast delivery would compete with Federal Express. And competitive products, the statute specifically says, and this is 3633, that each product has to cover its own costs. So Congress specifically tied to the product definition in the context of competitive products some of the rules. And the other thing is, you know, they point to the reporting requirement, which is just sort of a comprehensive requirement. You have to, for each market dominant product for which a discount is in effect, you have to report the data. And then the reporting requirements specifically require the commission to assess the legality of the rates that have been imposed for products individually or collectively. So there's really nothing in the statute that says, oh, this only works at the product level. It doesn't work at a more aggregated level. That's just not in the statute, and the statute makes perfect sense the way that it's written and the way that the commission has interpreted it. And then, as the commission pointed out, as a factual matter, there are these pre-sort bureaus. This is an example. The commission gave econometric evidence and other evidence, lots of evidence about the relationship between single-piece and first-class mail. But the simplest, perhaps, is there are entities, and you can say, I want to pre-sort my mail because I want to take advantage of the discount. And I will pay this entity money, and they will pre-sort my mail and take advantage of the discount. Now, if the discount is big enough that the amount that I have to pay to the pre-sort bureau is less than the amount that I'm getting from the discount, then it's worth doing that. Otherwise, I'll just send the mail out myself. I won't pay the pre-sort bureau. Now, this is a classic example of the size of the discount is governing whether someone more efficient is doing the work, whether it's the pre-sort bureau on the one hand or the Postal Service on the other hand. So it makes perfect sense to apply this, you know, the theory of the work share discount provision applies perfectly well to the difference between pre-sort and single-piece mail. The language of the statute applies perfectly well. There are policy arguments which they could either address to Congress or they could try to fit within one of the several exceptions to the statute. So they're really, the commission's reading, and on top of it all, of course, the commission gets Chevron deference. The statute certainly isn't clear in limiting this to within products when it doesn't say within products at all in 3622.
To the extent they want market flexibility, however, this impedes their market flexibility.
It does.
Right. Their theory is that the statute's primary objective was to increase the Postal Service's market flexibility so as to compete in a changing environment.
And there's no question that the statute, taken as a whole, greatly enhanced their flexibility. It got rid of the break-even requirement.
But it's still worried about monopoly power, right?
I mean,
it's a conundrum here, right? I mean, Congress is trying to thread the needle.
Right. It's still imposed. It didn't eliminate all regulation. It, you know, if they wanted maximum flexibility, they wouldn't have enacted 3622 at all. But they did enact it, and then some of the objectives of the statute, like the first one, for example, is about increasing efficiency, and, you know, incentives to reduce costs. So that would be one that that would be served by reading the discount provision the way it's written and the way the commission has interpreted it. And of course, there are other ways that they could, use flexibility. There's a cap at the class level, which means for all first class mail, to make sure they're not increasing prices too fast. And that's mainly a concern about monopoly power. Then there's the work share discount provision. And there's one other provision about certain preferred categories of mailers, like nonprofits. That's the list of things that restrict their flexibility that are mandatory, sort of specific quantitative provisions. So, you know, we gave this example in our brief. They say they don't want to do it, and that's fine because it's up to them. But they could, for example, distinguish among single piece mail. They could say, okay, if you're handwriting your address and putting a stamp on it, that costs us more to process, so we're going to charge more. If you're sending it out, in a sort of more machine-friendly way, we'll give you a discount. There might be some restrictions on that, but they certainly could do that. We're not saying they have to. They can. What Congress was doing was giving them flexibility. That's one way in which they have flexibility. But the main point is that the one thing that Congress made clear was that rate discounts for pre-sorting are subject to this provision unless one of the exceptions applies. And they can argue for an exception in a future proceeding if they want, but the provision applies on its face to the relationship at issue here. Unless there are more questions about that, I want to turn briefly to the other issue in the case. And this relates to, once it's a given that the work share discount provision applies, how is cost avoided calculated? And on this, as I mentioned at the outset, the Postal Service really doesn't have standing, because what the commission was doing basically was figuring out, okay, we know that the work share discount provision applies, and we're trying to figure out how to calculate cost avoided. And they were just choosing, just in broad strokes, between a narrow definition of cost avoided, which would lead to a lower estimate of cost avoided, or a broader definition that would lead to a higher estimate of cost avoided. And they picked the higher one. In other words, they said, if there are things you do that, you know, if someone's going to barcode their mail before they submit it to the Postal Service, then they need to make sure that the addresses comply with certain characteristics to make sure the barcoding is useful. And when we're figuring out how much it's worth to the Postal Service to have someone barcode, we will assume that they are doing the address cleansing, as they call it, also. And so the values of the Postal Service of barcoding, as measured by us, will be higher. And that all that's going to do is mean that the permissible size of the discount is greater. Now, that's perfectly consistent with the statute, but for standing purposes, also, a bigger permissible discount gives the Postal Service more flexibility, because the statute doesn't require any discount. The 3622 is just a ceiling on the size of discounts. It's not a floor. So if the commission had come out differently and they would have been allowed to give a discount of up to 3 cents, and now they can give a discount of up to 4 cents, the Postal Service is better off with the 4 cents than with the 3 cents, because they can do anything up to four in that hypothetical. So we think that that's pretty clear that they don't have standing, because it didn't harm them, and in fact it helped them. But that also, I think, is an explanation of why the commission's reasoning is right on the merits, because it's not expanding the definition of work sharing. It's saying, we know that the work share discount provision applies, and the question is, how are we measuring the cost? And so that's only going to come into play if they're doing one of the four things that's enumerated in the statute. So on that provision, I just wanted to make our points, but the standing point should be dispositive on that one. Unless there are any more questions. Thank you.
All right. Does Mr. Bell have any time? All right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Oh, thank you. The commission has suggested that we could define a new category of products, or we can do whatever we want with products. It's totally false. Okay? The commission determines what the products are. That's clear from 3621 and 3642. The commission determines what the products are, and that determination has consequences, because that is the distinction between the normal pricing rules, that if you have a product, the statute contemplates that you apply that price to a product based on its market and cost characteristics. Discounts are discounts within products. If the commission believes that we are trying to somehow evade the statute by miscategorizing things, it has a process to resolve that problem under 3642. And I want to quickly characterize, so this idea that it's up to us to do it is totally false. It's totally false. I mean, the reason single piece and pre-sort, first class mail, are separate products is because we asked them to approve it.
What about the idea, this is a slightly different point, but the idea that there is an exception in the statute if you don't like the limitation they've put on the discount?
That's because, again, these aren't discounts. We think Congress did not empower the commission to grant exceptions at its discretion. It did not give the commission the power to regulate or restrict the relative prices of separate products. I want to be clear on this product. I think where some of this confusion comes from is we have a product called pre-sort first class mail, and we have discounts that are often called sort of pre-sorting. They're different. Okay, again, for the pre-sort product, the product is bulk mail. It's bulk mail for major mailers subject to a bunch of additional requirements involving mail design, everything from ink color to paper stock to rigidity. This is it's very specialized mail. The discounts from that product are for sorting it by address. Okay, so the whole thing isn't a discount. It's a discount from the bulk mail product. So if you have a 500 piece mailing,
mail is a discount from the first class.
It's not. It's a totally different product. It's a different type of mail and different mailers. It has a host of requirements that have nothing to do with single piece. Is designed as a one size fits all. Look, I want to send a letter. I don't want to read the domestic mail manual. I will put a stamp on it. I'll run it through a meter. I'll send it. It's going to cost 46 cents. Mm-hmm. That's single piece first class mail. Mm-hmm. Businesses use it. Individuals use it. This mail is mail for specialists. If you have a single mailing of more than 500 pieces, and you want to comply with a host of requirements involving mail piece design, presentation, preparation, then you are a bulk mailer subject to the bulk mail product. If you then further want to pre-sort by address, you get discounts.
I got it. Can you quickly address standing on the second issue?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what else to say. This is a rulemaking.
On the second issue.
Oh, on the second issue.
I hear you on the first issue.
Right.
On the issue of the methodology for the discount.
Oh, on that issue.
Yeah.
I think that the problem
the
there.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. I misunderstood your question.
More beneficial to you than the alternative, so why are you harmed? I think that's the theory.
Right, sure. The answer to that question is by calling these things workshare discounts, as opposed to what they are, is just discounts having nothing to do with activities that replace work we do. It subjects discounts to restrictions under 3622E that are otherwise unrestricted by the statute. So, for example, we offer a discount.
Once you get past that into the size of the discount, so the methodology for the discount, I think they were saying that the methodology chosen gave you more flexibility than the alternative methodology they could have chosen, and why, therefore,
right,
within that analytical box, why are you harmed?
Well, the alternative methodology was false and invalid, as the commission recognized. So it's not like they could choose between choices of methodology. The method they chose was to use all metered mail, sort of as a proxy for businesses, as lower cost mail. The idea would be that sort of lower price meter mail should be benchmarked to pre-sort, and that way we would be free to freely raise the price of stamps on ordinary Americans. That's something we disagree with, but it's essentially what their analysis. So it's true that it gives us a little more flexibility to help big businesses, and that's good, and that's profitable. But there's cost to that. But again, I don't think it's a choice of methodology, because the methodology they had employed in the past was invalid. I mean, as they recognized, that's why they started the rulemaking on that question. But again, our key issue on this is that why would Congress have bothered to enact a law that gave the Postal Service flexibility, pricing flexibility, to price our products to the market, if at the same time, without announcing it, they were going to take away that flexibility entirely for most of our profitable products through the workshare discount provision, which itself doesn't talk about rates, doesn't talk about prices. It doesn't talk about rate differentials. It doesn't talk about relative rates. It doesn't talk about anything other than discounts from rates. The commission determines what the products are, and therefore determines what units rates can be applied to. Once it makes that determination, then we have the flexibility to price our products to the marketplace. It's that simple, and I think that the structure of the statute makes it very clear. I don't have anything else to say, Your Honor.
I've got one question.
Yeah, sure.
I'm afraid to ask because I
you don't want to know.
If the benchmark should not be metered mail, what should it be?
We have no problem if we are required to pretend that our most profitable product is not a product at all, but it's just a discount from some other product. We have no dispute with the benchmark they chose, because they are correct that the earlier benchmark they used was this fictional category of bulk metered mail. That product doesn't exist. I mean, there isn't. Their theory was that there are a bunch of bulk mailers out there, so they have massive mailings, but they're essentially just throwing them into a mailbox. That's not literally what it says, but that's sort of the theory, that we have all these bulk mailers out there that are paying single-piece rates, and we should benchmark the pre-sort, the bulk mail product, to that. They have since been convinced that there's always been a dispute over whether there are such mailers at all. The pre-sort bureaus really were aimed at those. The council spoke of the pre-sort bureaus. Those are aimed at high-volume mailers that essentially don't know about the domestic mail manual, don't know about the various requirements, don't know that they could actually be paying lower rates if they did certain things, like use a certain rigidity for their mail pieces, if they trade them, if they face them and did all that. That's what the pre-sort bureaus do. It's not like they're coming up to you and me and saying, hey, we can aggregate all your mail and you can get pre-sort prices. That can't happen. So. I've now lost my train of thought entirely.
let me tell you what I'm bothered by. If one looks at 3622E, it doesn't say products, right? It's not there. And so you have to resort to this argument of structure to say that it's clear. How often do we do that? How often do we bypass the specific provision at issue, which seems to indicate a different outcome than what you're referring to, and rely on structure and purpose? Isn't that a little bit dangerous?
That's a normal tool of statutory construction, Your Honor, that if you read the four corners of one provision is unclear because it doesn't mention the word product. And again, right. We would argue that's not surprising.
You got some examples of where we've done that? We bypassed the provision and went to the structure?
I can't cite any to you right now, but I think it is not uncommon for this court to say, okay, if I read the four corners of the challenged provision, I don't know the answer, but by reference to other simultaneously enacted provisions, it's obvious what Congress must have meant. Because the goal of this is not to discern what the plain language is, it's to discern congressional intent. And I think congressional intent is clear.
Is that the purpose?
That is ultimately the purpose. The best indicator of that is language. Sure, language, structure, and the rules of statutory construction, but the point is, what did Congress mean? And, I mean, the best indicator is, what did it say? We argue it is not at all surprising that it wouldn't mention the term product in 3622E itself, because the whole thing is about product.
I guess the question is it absolutely clear?
I would say that 3622E alone is maybe not all the way to being clear. Yeah, I think I would argue it is.
Mostly clear.
I think it's mostly clear. No, I think that's fair to say, because the whole thing is about products. The entire the opening section of the statute talks about rates for market-dominant products. The whole thing is about products. So its absence in that one provision is not surprising at all. The whole thing is about products. But I think what makes it clear is when you combine it with the reporting requirement, which is now outside of the world where we're talking just about products, and it says you have to report information for your market-dominant products for which there is a work-share discount. I think you combine those two, and it's entirely clear. That's all I have, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.